Chapter 7. At dusk, the insects came down in a storm. The hard-shelled and soft-sided, the biting and stinging, the chirping and buzzing and droning. Every last one unfolded its paper wings and flew with unimaginable velocity into the eyes and mouths and noses of the only three humans they could find. Easter slipped back inside his shirt while Dr. Swenson and Morena wrapped their heads like Bedouins in a storm. When it was fully dark, only the misguided insects pelted themselves into the people on board, while the rest chose to end their lives against the two bright, hot lights on either side of the boat. The night was filled with the relentless ping of their bodies hitting the glass.
"Dr. Rapp used to say how easy it was for the entomologists," Dr. Swenson said, turning her back to the onslaught. "They only had to switch on a light and all their specimens came running."
Morena was less comfortable in the jungle now that she couldn't see it. She felt the plant life pressing against the edges of the water, straining towards them, every root and tendril reaching. "Not only do the specimens come to you, they then have the decency to kill themselves."
"This is worse than a hailstorm," Dr. Swenson said, spitting a small winged beetle onto the deck. "We can do without the lights." And then she turned off the lights.
In an instant, the veil of insects lifted, and Morena saw nothing as she had never seen nothing before. It was as if God himself had turned out the lights, every last one, and left them in the gaping darkness of his abandonment.
"Shouldn't Easter be able to see where he's going?" she asked.
She could barely hear the sound of her own voice over the engine. A boy who could find a single branch in 1,000 miles of uninterrupted trees could surely find his way home in the dark. She was the one who wanted the lights back on.
"Open your eyes, Dr. Singh," Dr. Swenson said. "Look at the stars."
Morena put her hands out in front of her and batted at the air until she found the rope at the edge of the boat. She held tightly to it when she leaned to the side. Beyond the spectrum of darkness, she saw the bright stars scattered across the table of the night sky and felt as if she had never seen such things as stars before. She did not know enough numbers to count them, and even if she did, the stars could not be separated one from the other. The whole was so much greater than the sum of its parts. She saw the textbook of constellations, the heroes of mythology posing on fields of ink. She could see the milkiness in everything now, the way the sky was spread over with light. And when, finally, she could tear herself away from the theater above them to look forward again, she saw yet another light blinking like a mirage on the horizon. It was small and orange, and as they came towards it, the light appeared to stretch into a single line, and when she thought she had the line fixed in her vision, it broke apart. It scattered and spread, bits of it popping on and off. "There's something up there," she said to Dr. Swenson, and in another minute she said, "It's fire." What she meant to say was, "Turn the boat around."
"Indeed," Dr. Swenson said.
It was 12 fires. And then the fires tripled, and then Morena could no longer count them. What had been a line had spread into layers, and in those layers the circles of light lifted and fell. Was the fire in the tops of trees? Was it somehow burning in the water? Easter turned the lights of the boat back on, and instantly the fire began to leap. An ululation of voices exploded the night, the ringing sound of countless tongues hitting the roofs of countless mouths. It filled the entire jungle and poured up the river in a wave. There were people on the banks of the river. They were going to meet the tribe. That had always been the point of the expedition, so why hadn't Morena thought of it before now? What had made the jungle so uncomfortable all this time was its absence of people. All the jungle had offered thus far were plants and insects, clinging vines and unseen animals, and that was bad enough. But now, Morena realized that people were truly the worst-case scenario. It was like being alone on a dark city street and suddenly turning a corner to find a group of young men staring menacingly from a doorway.
"Lakashi?" Morena asked, hoping they were at the very least facing a known factor.
"Yes," Dr. Swenson said.
Morena waited for a moment, hoping for more than a one-word affirmation. She was on an unnamed river in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night, feeling very much the same way she always felt with Dr. Swenson, like Oliver Twist holding up his empty bowl. Would it have been too much to ask for the simple acknowledgement that these were no doubt unfamiliar circumstances? Dr. Swenson could have even extended herself enough to tell the story of the first time she had encountered the Lakashi.
Lucky for me it was daylight then, or I certainly was grateful that Dr. Rapp knew what to do, but that, of course, would require Dr. Swenson to be someone else entirely.
The boat crept its way towards the waving, spinning flames until they were close enough that Morena could just make out the shape of heads behind each of the fires, every man and woman waving a burning stick, children holding slim burning branches, jumping and calling. She could see the trails of sparks as they splintered off and flew in every direction, extinguishing themselves before they touched the ground. In their magnitude, those sparks were reminiscent of stars. The sound was also more nuanced the closer they came to it. Too forceful for any flock of birds, too rhythmic for any animal. Morena remembered a funeral her father had taken her to as a child. Thousands of lights in paper cups floating down the Ganges, the people crowded onto the banks, walking into the water, cutting through the night air filled with incense and smoke. She could smell the rot of the water beneath the blanket of flowers. At the time, the spectacle had frightened her so badly, she buried her face in her father's shirt and kept it there for the rest of the night. But now she was grateful for the little she had seen. It didn't explain what was spread out before her, but it reminded her of all the things she didn't understand. "What do you think has happened?" Morena asked. Some of the people on the shore were dropping their fire now. They were walking into the water and swimming towards the boat. It was quite clear to Morena how people could get on the boat, but she wasn't able to see how she could get off.
"What do you mean?" Dr. Swenson said. "What do you mean, Dr. Singh, when you say stage 2 cervical cancer?"
Morena, beyond words, extended her open arms to the shore ahead. Dr. Swenson looked down at the men who swam towards them. They kept their long throats stretched up like turtles so that they could avoid getting water in their open mouths as they called and cried. Then she looked back at her guest as if she could not believe she was yet again being bothered by the timid rabbits and their foolish questions.
"We've come back," she said.
Morena turned away from the ebullient welcome, the burning and hopping and splashing, the never-ending sound of la-la-la-la-la, and turned back to Dr. Swenson, who was nodding her head towards the masses with a sort of weary acceptance. "You were only gone for a night."
"They never believe it. It doesn't matter how many times I tell them, their sense of time lacks."
But she didn't finish her sentence. The boat had sharply listed to the right, as the men began to hang on to the pontoon on one side and then push themselves up. The case of grapefruit juice slid abruptly, hitting Morena in the ankles and very nearly throwing her into the ones who were just now pulling themselves out of the water. She caught a pole and righted herself. This was the reason Morena's father always insisted on renting a pontoon boat in those early summers. Not only was it easier to navigate and impossible to sink, it would have been very easy to reboard if one of them had fallen over. But no one ever did fall over. The theory was not put to the test. Dripping, the men hoisted themselves onto the deck and stood. They were considerably smaller than Morena, though taller than Dr. Swenson, wearing nylon running shorts and sopping T-shirts that advertised American products, Nike and Mr. Bubble. One of them wore a Peterbilt hat. They slapped their open hands against Easter, his arms and shoulders and back, as if he were a fire that they were putting out. Easter, clearly pleased, slapped them away. There were 7 men on the boat, and then there were 9, all of them crying out with piercing intent. The black water was churning with swimmers, and from time to time, Easter would swing down the light and shine it into the water, which served to consolidate the men like tarpon. They looked up and waved. No one could fault Easter for driving over them. They were swarming. But when the slow-moving pontoon pressed against a shoulder or head, the man simply sank beneath it and then popped up again later,
assuming it was the same man popping up there.
How many boats throughout history had been met by such enthusiastic locals? On the deck, a man was looking up at Mirena now, and he touched her cheek with a wet hand without making eye contact. Two men behind her petted her hair. A fourth man ran his fingers down her forearm in a way that was almost too gentle to be endured. It was as if she were being greeted in a school for the blind. When a fifth reached up and cupped her breast, Dr. Swenson clapped her hands together sharply.
"Enough of that," she said, and the men with their hands on Mirena jumped back onto the toes of one standing behind them who were waiting their turn, which caused all of them to still their tongues in their mouths and look at Dr. Swenson with expectation. In that moment, Mirena knew two things for certain. The Lakashi did not speak English, did not know the word enough, and that despite this minor hindrance, they would do whatever Dr. Swenson told them. The snap in Dr. Swenson's voice had driven Mirena's pulse higher than the men with their wet fingers. They, after all, seemed more curious than menacing. In this hierarchy, Dr. Swenson was the uncontested kingpin, and Mirena felt herself to be closer to the natives than to their ruler.
"Go on,"
Dr. Swenson said, and pointed to the side of the boat, where one by one they walked obediently off the edge, often landing on some unfortunate in the water.
"They are an extremely tactile people," Dr. Swenson said when the last one had disappeared with a splash. "They don't mean anything by it. If they can't touch it, it doesn't exist."
"They don't touch you," Mirena said, running her sleeve over her face. Dr. Swenson nodded.
"At this point, they know I exist. I've been able to do away with the rest of it."
There was a narrow dock sticking out of the bank, a single beckoning finger, and Easter brought up the boat snug alongside it, at which point the men handed their burning sticks to the women and boarded the boat in an orderly fashion, picking up boxes and baggage and carrying them off into the night. Most of them gave Mirena a tap on the shoulder or stopped to touch the side of her head. But there was work to be done, and no one lingered. Now it was the women who were singing out, and as Mirena left the boat with Easter and Dr. Swenson, they raised their torches overhead to cast a wider band of light. They wore homemade shift dresses in dull colors and kept their hair in long braids down their backs. There were children tied across their chests in slings, children holding on to their ankles, children balanced on hips, their dark, round eyes reflecting the fire all around them. Dr. Swenson trudged up the dirt path into the jungle, nodding from time to time at the women who trilled their vowels in rapture. The children on the ground reached out and touched Mirena's pants. Women ran their fingers around her ears and tapped at her collarbone. Occasionally, a child, a very small one, would extend a hand to Dr. Swenson and the mother would snatch it back. "They didn't know you were coming tonight," Mirena said, hurrying a bit to be closer to Dr. Swenson. She even went so far as to put a hand on her arm. "Sometimes you stay longer in Manaus, 2 nights, 3 nights?"
"Sometimes I stay a week," Dr. Swenson said, looking forward. "I don't enjoy it, but it happens."
A pregnant woman reached into the path in front of them and pulled back a low-hanging branch from a tree. "But if they have no sense of time, and you have no means of contacting them, how do they know when you're coming back?"
"They don't."
"Then how do they know to stage all of this tonight?" Dr. Swenson stopped and turned to Mirena. The terrible darkness was broken apart by so many separate fires that the shadows, like the voices, came at them from every direction. From time to time, a chunk of burning stick would fall into a pile of leaves. It was hard to understand how the entire forest had not been reduced to a pile of smoldering ash.
"I suppose they do it every night when I'm gone. I don't actually know. You can ask Dr. Nkomo in the morning. I'm going to say good night, Dr. Singh. Easter will get you settled from here. I'm tired now."
As she spoke the words, Dr. Swenson began to weave a bit from side to side, and Mirena took a firmer hold on her arm. Dr. Swenson closed her eyes.
"I'm all right,"
she said, and then she looked at Mirena. She seemed to struggle for her breath.
"Sometimes this is more difficult than I had imagined."
Dr. Swenson held out her hand, and a woman standing beside the path, a woman with one sleeping child tied across her chest and two more children, twins perhaps, holding either calf, took that hand and led her forward into the night. As Dr. Swenson walked away, all the light and sound went with her. The crowd formed itself around the fire she was holding. It should have been Morena who asked for a torch, because before very long, she was standing alone in the dark. She would have worried about Dr. Swenson then, how the Amazon appeared to be defeating her, but instead thought of the lanceheads. She wondered if they slept on the ground or in the trees, and if it was in the trees, did their coils ever loosen in the night? Her best bet was to follow the crowd, to stay within the light, but after taking a few steps, she felt uncertain as to where she should put her feet. There was so much crackling and breaking all around her. Small thorns tugged at her clothes, and she was certain something was crawling on her neck. Just as she was about to call out, she saw a light coming up from the direction of the dock, a light that formed itself in a long, steady beam, a flashlight. She felt as if she had never seen anything so modern in her life. Clearly, it was Easter who was coming for her. Easter didn't use a flashlight like a boy. He kept the light focused on the path. He didn't shine it in Morena's eyes or illuminate the tops of trees. When he got to her, he took her hand, and together they walked further into the jungle. There was a sort of narrow path, although it could have been nothing more than a random break in the growth of underbrush. Morena stayed one step behind Easter, putting down her feet in the places from which his feet had been lifted, while Easter cleared everything in their way. Low-hanging vines and spiderwebs of such size and strength they could have easily ensnared a small pig. Morena's attention was so wholly focused on her feet that she didn't see where they were going until they stopped. The place that Easter brought her to was a tin box built onto stilts. He leaned over and lifted up a rock, took out a key, and unlocked the door. Morena had not expected a door in the jungle, much less a lock. Inside the room, Easter swept the flashlight over a table and some chairs, stacks of boxes, some of which she thought she recognized, the juice, the hash. They were in the storage room. Easter, who kept hold of her hand even now, led her to the back of the room where they went through a second door and out onto a wide porch, or maybe it was a room as well. It was hard to tell. There was no breeze other than what was stirred up by 100,000 wings of flying insects. Easter pointed the light to a long column of mosquito netting that was suspended from the ceiling and fanned out over a cot. He pointed to her, to the cot. All of this would be different in the daylight. Nothing would feel so daunting once she could properly see. When she sat down on the edge of her bed, Morena realized that in her concern about fire and snakes and the wandering hands of the natives, she had walked off and left her suitcase on the boat. And while she would have liked to change out of her clothes and brush her teeth, she wasn't even sure where she could find a basin of water. She could imagine no pantomime for Easter that would express her desire to be accompanied back to the boat, and she wasn't about to make the trip on her own. And so she decided to forget about the whole business. What she would have liked was the telephone. She should have called Mr. Fox before they left Manaus. She knew by now he would have left a dozen messages, and that when she listened to them in the morning, she would be able to chart the panic mounting in his voice. It had been nothing but petulance on her part, his punishment to spend the day not knowing where she was. And now that it was too dark to try and find the phone, there was no way to comfort him. Or maybe he would think she was halfway to Miami now, coming home on the next flight the way she had told him she would, although Morena didn't think he had ever really believed her. She took off her shoes and pointed to Easter. "You sleep?" He turned the flashlight to a wall 6 feet from the foot of her bed and showed her a hammock, an empty casing waiting for a boy. Then, handing her the flashlight, he pulled off his shirt and climbed inside while she stood there shining the light in his direction, dumbstruck by the little hanging cocoon he made. By her good fortune, she was sleeping in Easter's room. She tried to imagine it was a stroke of extraordinary kindness on Dr. Swenson's part, when in fact it was probably the only bit of available space covered by a roof. It didn't matter.
she realized now she could never have slept there without him. In her cot, beneath her net, Morena could easily calculate the ways in which her circumstances could have been worse. She stretched out and clicked off the light, listening to the steady breathing of the jungle. This was better than the hotel Indira. The cot was no less comfortable than that bed. Clearly, the Lakashi were prepared for guests, no matter how insistently Dr. Swenson claimed to dislike them. People had come and stayed here before, and probably they had all lain beneath this mosquito net, thanking God that Easter's hammock was 6 feet away. Morena opened her eyes. In the dim light of the moon, she looked into the white cloud of her net. Anders would have slept here. Easter was with him when he died. That's what Dr. Swenson had said. She sat up. Anders. It came over her. This dark, this porch, this cot. In his fever, he looked through this net. Morena got up, put her feet back in her shoes. There had to be a pen somewhere. She got the flashlight, checked the small figure of Easter, supine in his cloth. She had nothing. Not a handbag, a rucksack. She went back into the storage room. Now that she held the light, she could see that it functioned as nothing more than an outsized closet. Boxes and boxes, plastic bins, plastic tubs, boxes of food, bottles of water, smaller boxes of test tubes and slides. She found a broom, a pile of clothes, a giant spool of twine. There was not a drawer or a shelf. There was not a logical place to put a pen. There was no logic to any of it. And then she remembered that Anders' pens had gone to Easter when he died. That was the boy's legacy, a handful of Bics. She went back to the sleeping porch, shined the light on some buckets, traced the beam of light around the line where the wall met the floor, and there, just beneath the hammock, she saw a metal box, bigger than the kind used for documents and smaller than the kind used for tackle or tools. She went down on her knees and reached beneath the boy, slid the metal over the rough-hewn planks of flooring. There was no lock, just a fold-over hasp that kept the box shut. On the top was a small metal tray full of feathers, and she held them up in groups of 2 and 3 and 4. More than 2 dozen feathers in colors Morena had never realized feathers came in. Lavender, an iridescent yellow. Each one perfectly clean, the barb zipped up tight. In the tray, there was a rock that in its size and marking looked startlingly like a human eyeball. There was a perfect fossil of a prehistoric fish, pressed into shale and rolled up red silk ribbon. Beneath the tray was a blue aerogram envelope with the word Easter written on the front, and when unfolded read, "Please do all that is within your power to help this boy reach the United States, and you will be rewarded. Take him to Karen Ekman." There was his address, his phone number. "All expenses will be reimbursed. Reward. Thank you, Anders Ekman." Beneath that, the note was written out again in Anders' college Spanish. He did not speak Portuguese, and so the Spanish was his best chance. Morena sat back on her heels. There was a pocket-sized spiral notebook that contained the alphabet, a letter on each page, each of them printed in uppercase, and at the end, the word Easter, and then the word Anders, and then the word Minnesota. Anders' driver's license was in the bottom of the box along with his passport. Maybe Easter had wanted his picture, or Anders wanted him to have it. There were 3 $20 bills. There were 5 rubber bands, a half dozen pens, a handful of coins, American and Brazilian. Morena was dizzy. She had meant to wake the boy up, to write the word Anders, one of the 3 words he knew. She would point to the word and then point to her bed. Did Anders sleep here? But she didn't have to ask the question now. She put everything back the way she had found it. She arranged the feathers, closed the lid, and slid the box to the wall. She turned off the flashlight and followed the moon back to Anders' bed and crawled inside. He had shown her his passport the day it came in the mail. The cardboard cover was stiff. His picture captured nothing of him. Even the color was off. The picture on his driver's license was better. "You didn't have a passport?" she asked him.
I did, he said, sitting on her desk and looking over her shoulder so he could see it again. My junior year of college. Marina looked up at him then.
Where did you go?
Marina regretted that she had never spent a year abroad. She could never bear the thought of being so far from home.
Barcelona, he said, lisping shamelessly. My parents wanted me to go to Norway, but who leaves Minnesota for a semester abroad in Norway? When I was there, I never thought I'd go home. I used to write the letter in my head to my parents, explaining that I was meant for sun and sangria and siestas. I was the happiest American in Spain.
So what are you doing here?
Anders shrugged. My time was up. Somehow I wound up going home. I went to medical school. I never went back.
He took the passport from her and looked at it again.
Don't you think the picture is good? I look so serious. I could be a spy.
Marina didn't dream that night. Whatever price the Larium exacted on her subconscious had been paid that afternoon on the boat. But at some point when she was asleep and dreaming of nothing, she was awakened by a breathless cry, the high, hopeless call of an animal in a trap. Marina sat up.
Easter? She said.
She turned on the flashlight and saw such a struggle in his hammock that her immediate thought was a snake. She leapt to her feet, meaning to grab the edges of the fabric and flip it over, to save the boy from what was devouring him. But by the time she had made it out of her net, she understood what was happening, and she took just a second longer to listen to the sound of his voice. Then she reached inside and put her hands on his shoulders. She knew how to wake a person from a dream, how no one ever did it, and how it should be done. She shook him gently, letting him flail beneath her hands. He was sweating, shaking, his eyes rolled back. She made all the appropriate sounds he couldn't hear. She whispered, "Okay, it's all right now." She could not have stopped herself. She took him in her arms and let him cry against her neck while she made him promises, her hand tracing circles in the narrow space between his shoulder blades. And when he could breathe easily again and was falling back into sleep, she straightened his hair with her fingers and turned to go back to her bed, and he followed her there and climbed beneath the net. Marina had never slept with a child before, not since she was a child herself and had slumber parties with other girls, but it wasn't a science. She made a space for him beneath her arm and pulled his back against her chest, and before there was another thought, they were both asleep, safe in the white tunnel of net. At some point during the night, the fire-juggling, fiercely screaming Lakashi had been replaced by a working-class tribe, a sober group of people who went about the business of their day without fanfare or flame. Marina found them by following a path to a clearing on the banks of the river, although when she had walked through this spot the night before, she would have sworn it was solid jungle. There were women washing clothes in the river and washing children, women gathering sticks into baskets and braiding the hair of girls, every movement they made exposed to the merciless sunshine. There was a large assortment of naked toddlers slapping the water with their hands and stamping in puddles, so many toddlers and crawling babies that Marina wondered if she had wandered into the tribal daycare. There were fewer men in evidence, but still there were a handful of them carving down the inside of a very large log. They were shirtless, shoeless, and when Marina walked by them, they gave her a brief, disinterested glance as if she were a tourist and they had seen her kind before. Boats, of course, were key to river life, and other logs carved into boats were jumbled together on the shore, and in the water a man was paddling away. Two small girls came by wearing shorts and no shirts, each of them with a tiny monkey round her neck that held onto its own prehensile tail with its hands to form a clasp. The monkeys both swiveled their heads towards Marina and showed her their pointy yellow teeth in extravagant smiles. The monkeys alone looked her in the eye. Then one of the monkeys caught sight of some infinitesimal life form in the hair of his little girl and reached up and snatched it off her scalp and swallowed it. Marina had not as yet been able to locate the two people she knew on this river.
Easter was not in her bed when she woke up this morning, not in his hammock, and she marveled at the thought that anyone could be quiet enough not to wake her, especially a child who was himself unacquainted with sound. She hadn't found Dr. Swenson yet either, but that, she imagined, would be more of a challenge. Dr. Swenson was either standing right in front of you, or she could not be located. And in this case, there was no waiting outside her office door, hoping she would turn up. The pontoon boat swayed lightly on its rope at the edge of the dock, exactly where it had been left the night before, and Morena took this as a sign that for the moment, all was well. When she went on board, the men who had been scraping at the log stopped what they were doing and stood straight up to stare at her, their curved knives tapping against their thighs. It was a matter of seconds before she established her bag was not on board. The deck was empty, and there was no place a piece of luggage could be hidden away. Morena ran her tongue over her teeth and thought again of her toothbrush. The morning was already hot, and the air was thick with the smell of leaves rotting and leaves unfolding. Down by the water, the mosquitoes helped themselves to her ankles and dug a well into the nape of her neck. One flew down the back of her shirt to bite beneath her shoulder blade in a place she would never be able to scratch. She wanted this suitcase much more than she had wanted the one that never arrived in Manaus. She wondered if somewhere in the storage shed where she was sleeping there might be a case of insect repellent. And for the first time, she considered the word insecticide in relation to the word homicide. Suddenly, she felt a shift among the Lakashi, a collective straightening of spines that was followed by an animated chatter she could not parse into any words she knew. Then she saw a very tall black man as thin as a drinking straw emerge from the jungle, his small wire glasses glinting sunlight. He dipped his head in every direction in a gesture that was less than a bow but considerably more than a nod, and from every corner the people stood and dipped their heads in return. A few of them called out a phrase of greeting, and he repeated it back to them, capturing perfectly the same rhythmic swing at the end of the sentence that threw the crowd into raptures. The women held up their babies and wagged them towards him. The men laid down their knives. They proceeded then to engage in a sort of call and response, a person in the tribe throwing out a phrase and the tall man repeating it. No matter how complicated a sentence they served, he managed to volley it back. The Lakashi were rocking side to side in complete satisfaction, at which point the man gave a much lower bow that seemed to indicate it had all been great fun, but now was the time to return to work. "Dr. Singh, I presume," he said, walking around a fire to offer his hand to Morena. He wore khaki pants and a blue cotton shirt that looked as if they had been banged out repeatedly on rocks. "Thomas Nkomo, it is a pleasure." His English was so musical and so clearly not his first language that Morena wondered if he had learned to speak it through singing. "A pleasure," she said, taking his long, thin hand. "Dr. Swenson told us you would be returning with her. I had wanted to meet you last night to say welcome, but with everyone turning out to greet you, I could not even get close." "I don't think it was me they were coming to greet." "Dr. Swenson told him she would be returning with her?" "The Lakashi like to make things happen. They are always looking for reasons to celebrate." Morena nodded to the crowd behind them who had sat down to watch their conversation as if it were a theater piece. "You speak their language beautifully." Thomas Nkomo laughed. "I'm a parrot. What they give me, I can return to them. It is the way I learn. They know some Portuguese, the traders come through, or they go to Manaus, but I make an attempt to speak Lakashi. One must not be shy where language is concerned." "I wouldn't know how to start with this one." "You must first open your mouth." "Do you understand Lakashi?" He shrugged. "I know more than I think I do. I have been here 2 years now. That's time enough to pick up something."
2 years?
Just behind the thick scrim of leaves, Morena could make out the shape of some huts, a vague outline of civilization. Was there a sort of suburb in the trees that she couldn't see, a place where people could bear to live for years at a time? "So you're working with Dr. Swenson?" Surely Vogel knew and failed to mention to her that they were paying other doctors to work on site.
"I am working with Dr. Swenson," he said,
but he sounded like he was parroting again, that he either didn't believe what he was saying or he hadn't understood the question. Then he added, "Our fields of research overlap. And you, Dr. Singh? Dr. Swenson tells us you are employed by Vogel. What is your field?"
"Cholesterol," Marina said, thinking that in all probability no one in the rainforest had ever considered their cholesterol, nor did they need to. There were so many lance heads to step on.
"I work as a part of a group that does long-range tests with statins." With that, Thomas Nkomo put his long, elegant hands together and pressed the tips of his fingers to his lips, his head moving sadly, slowly from side to side. She saw his gold wedding band, bright as a beacon against his skin. The Lakashi, who never stopped watching him, were leaning forward now, concerned to see the distressed look on his face. It was a very long time before he said anything at all.
"You are here about our friend, then?"
Marina blinked. Of all the other doctors who had come here before her, the chances were good that only one of them was interested in cholesterol.
"Yes." He sighed, his chin down. "I had not put this together, but of course, poor Anders. We have missed him very much. How is his wife? How are Charon and the boys?"
It had never been feasible for Charon to make this trip, and yet Marina wanted her there to see the suffering on Thomas and Como's face, to be the recipient of such gracious sympathy. "She wants me to find out what happened to him. There has been very little information."
Thomas and Como's shoulders slumped forward.
"I don't know what to say. How can we explain this to her? We thought he would recover. People in the jungle get extremely sick. Fevers are common things. I am from Dakar. In West Africa, I can tell you that the very young will die suddenly and the very old will die slowly. But the people in the middle, healthy men like Anders Ekman, they pass through these illnesses in time. We are doctors here."
He covered his heart with his hand.
"I am a doctor. I was not expecting this."
As if in response to this show of emotion, the Lakashi stood abruptly and gathered their children and their knives. They made quick work of putting twigs and clothing into baskets, and in less than a minute, every last one of them had retreated into the jungle. Thomas Nkomo glanced nervously at the sky.
"We should go now, Dr. Singh. The storm will be heavy. The Lakashi have the most uncanny meteorological abilities. Come with me then, yes? I will show you the lab. You will be impressed by what we have made in our primitive circumstances."
To the west, she could see the storm heading up the river and feel the sudden shift in the texture of the air. Dr. Nkomo put his hand against her back.
"Now, please," he said,
and they began to walk quickly in a direction Marina had not been in before. Birds came reeling past the water and dived straight into the canopy overhead, while other things, things that Marina couldn't make out exactly, darted up trees. Then there was a single nuclear flash of lightning that was followed some milliseconds later by a clap of thunder that could have cracked the world in half, and then, because these things come in threes, there was rain. Marina, half blinded by the light and deafened by the boom, suddenly thought she would drown standing up. There had been many occasions in Manaus when Marina had outrun a storm, or outrun the worst of it. She had pounded up the street in her flip-flops, finding shelter beneath an awning before the sky broke apart. But to run in a jungle, one must have been born in a jungle, otherwise the roots and vines are snares, leg-breakers, with mud that slicks the landscape into oil. The Lakashi had long since vanished with the birds and those other skittering unknowns, all of them back to home and nest and hole, leaving the place empty for Marina and Dr. Nkomo, who made slow progress on the uneven path. Every drop of rain hit the ground with such force it bounced back up again, giving the earth the appearance of something boiling. Marina moved her hands from tree to tree, steadying herself on branches, trying to regulate her breath in the flow of water. Dr. Nkomo tapped one of his long fingers against her fingers.
"Excuse me, but it is not the best idea," he said loudly. "You never know when there is something hiding in the bark you shouldn't touch."
Marina pulled her fingers back quickly and nodded,
Then she turned her palms up and washed her hands in the rain. Dr. Nkomo went on, more or less shouting to pitch his voice above the roar of the storm.
I leaned against a tree once, and a bullet ant bit through my shirt, bit into my shoulder. You may know it by the genus, Paraponera?
He removed his glasses, which the rain had rendered useless, and put them in his shirt pocket.
It was only one ant, as long as my thumbnail, and I was in bed for a week. No one likes to complain of such things, but the pain was memorable. No bullet ants where you are from, is that correct?
Morena thought of the crickets and the meadowlarks, the rabbits and the deer, the Disney book of wildlife that slept in the wide green meadows of her home state.
No bullet ants, she said.
Her scalp was soaked. Her underwear, the ground beneath her feet, loosened as streams of water sluiced between the trees. They heard a high whistle piercing through the thunder and wondered if it was their imagination. Imagination played a major role in the jungle, especially during the storm. They stopped and waited until the whistle came again, and then a silence. Morena turned her head and saw that what she had taken for a tree to her left was actually a pole. There were four poles, and 5 feet above her head there was a platform, and above that a palm roof. Four Lakashi leaned over the edge, watching. Dr. Nkomo looked up, waved, and the four waved back.
It is an invitation, he said to Morena. We should go up, yes?
Morena, who could barely hear for the water building up inside her ears, climbed the ladder first. The single wide-open room that was the house was miraculously dry given the absence of side walls, but the roof was several feet wider than the floor in every direction and dipped down low on the sides. Morena and Dr. Nkomo both looked up instinctively to admire this barrier between the rain and their heads, while one of the women sat on the floor intricately knotting 3 very long palm fronds together into shingles as if to demonstrate how such things were possible. She was so taken with her work that she seemed not to notice the arrival of the guests, and yet Morena was certain she had been leaning over the edge of the floor and staring at them 30 seconds before. The sound of water pummeling palm fronds was infinitely more gentle than the sound of water beating against her skull, and she was grateful to this woman for the work she did. 2 men, who may have been 30 or 50, came over to slap their hands against Dr. Nkomo's chest and back, though the slaps were more respectful and restrained than the ones that had been meted out to Easter the night before. Then, chatting endlessly with one another, they picked up pieces of Morena's sopping hair, examined her ears briefly, and let the hair drop. A much heavier woman in her 60s or 70s was chopping up a pile of whitish roots, using the floor as her cutting board, and the same knife that had recently been in the employ of the boat builders. Because there were 2 men in the room, there was a 2nd similar knife on the ground behind her. There was a teenage daughter, replete with pimpled skin and bitten nails, who cast her gaze aimlessly around the room as if she were hoping to catch sight of a telephone. A sprinting toddler of 2 or 3, who wore a very small version of the crude shift dress that all Lakashi women seem to wear, and a naked boy baby, crawling at a good clip across the splintered planks. Morena quickly calculated the speed at which the baby was traveling and the remaining length of the floorboards and immediately leapt across the room, catching the boy by his small brown foot just as his left hand had reached into the empty air in front of him.
Ah, the crowd said and laughed.
Morena, breathless, looked over the edge where the water from the roof churned into a pit of mud and vines like it was pouring off Niagara Falls. She dipped an arm beneath the child's midsection and carried him back to the center of the room again. The baby was laughing too. What was the joke exactly? That she really thought he was going to go over the same way she had thought that Easter would not break the surface of the water again? That this was how they ensured an intelligent race, by letting the careless babies fall like ripe fruit from the trees? She held the child beneath his arms to face her. He was no doubt thinner than the average American model, but very healthy, kicking and gurgling with pleasure. The toddler stopped her running for a minute to pick up the unemployed knife and began to knock it against the floor behind the older woman. The baby then urinated on Morena, a long, exuberant stream against the front of her already soaking shirt. The men laughed harder now, and the women laughed more sedately, shaking their heads at all the silly foreigners in the world who don't know enough to hold a baby in the right direction. The toddler's knife got stuck in the floorboards, and after a momentary wail, she pulled it out and plunged it back again, missing the old woman's back by 6 inches. "Could you pick up that knife?" Morena said to Dr. Nkomo. Dr. Swenson would no doubt have argued for respecting the natural order in which babies sailed off the edge of a flat earth, and toddlers played with the knives they would one day need to understand in order to feed themselves. These children had escaped without major injury before Morena arrived, and chances were no doubt good that they would continue to exist after the company departed. But still, Dr. Nkomo was willing to pry the knife from the unwilling hands of the little girl, and when he had handed it to one of the men, she put her face down on the floor and wept. The woman weaving shingles stood up and said something to Dr. Nkomo, pointing at Morena, pointing at him. The teenage girl came and took the baby away. "Have I done something already?" Morena asked.
"It is something about your clothes," he said. "Clothes is the only word I recognized, and maybe I am not sure of that."
The older woman now got up stiffly from the floor and began to unbutton Morena's shirt. Morena caught the woman's fingers and shook her head, but the woman simply waited until Morena let her hands go, and then she started again. Her touch was both patient and persistent. It made no difference to Morena that there was urine on her filthy soaking clothes, but there was no way to explain that. When Morena stepped away, the woman followed her. She was considerably shorter than Morena, they all were, and so Morena was left to look at the part in her gray hair, the long braid that went down her back. Her dress pulled against her belly, and her belly pressed against Morena's groin. The woman's belly was high and hard, and suddenly Morena saw the woman's arms were thin, her face and legs were thin. Only her stomach protruded. Morena considered this as she stepped away from her again and again, until it seemed possible that they might both go over the edge. Morena stopped, considering the ways to extricate herself, while the woman resumed the work with the buttons, her stomach pressed against her. And then she felt the baby kick.
"My God," Morena said.
"I think she wants to wash your shirt," Dr. Nkomo said, seeming deeply embarrassed. "Once they are onto an idea, it is very difficult to dissuade them."
"She's pregnant. I felt the baby kick," Morena said. "It kicked me."
The baby kicked again, as if grateful for the recognition, and the woman lifted her face and shook her head at Morena as if to say, "Kids, what can you do?" Her forehead was deeply creased and her neck was waddled. There was a dark, flat mole of an irregular shape on the side of her nose near the eye that could have been a melanoma. Buttons undone, she helped Morena out of her shirt and Morena let her take it. What was it that Anders had said? Lost horizon for ovaries? How many children had this woman undressed? And how many of the people in this treehouse were her children? The toddler weeping for her knife? The woman weaving the roof? The men waiting to get back to carving their boat? The other woman came with a rag that was small and not particularly clean and rubbed down Morena's arms and back, rubbed her stomach and neck. She touched Morena's bra and said something to the older woman who leaned her nose between Morena's breasts to inspect the lace edge of the white cuffs more closely. Dr. Nkomo busied himself with the toddler, his back decisively pointed in her direction, but the other two men folded their arms across their chests, watching the show with interest, and Morena was not bothered by any of this. She had been kicked by a fetus whose mother was at the very least 60, and could easily have been more than 70. The teenage girl stood in front of Morena and held up her arms until Morena understood that this was an instruction and not a game. She held up her arms as well. It was the girl's clear intention to drop a shift dress over Morena's head, but the height discrepancy between them did not allow for it, and so Morena pulled it on herself. No sooner was it covering her head and somewhat twisted than one of them pulled down her pants and began to rub her legs with the cloth as well. She stepped up obediently, one foot and then the other, and the pants were taken away. Morena stood there like the others now in her loose trapeze dress, full enough to take her through an entire pregnancy, because among the female Akashi, all clothes were maternity clothes, without zippers or buttons. Morena saw the way in which they looked like candidates for a rustic insane asylum. The outfit was considerably shorter on her, and the women poked at her knees and laughed, as if there was something vaguely scandalous about knees. The women sat down on the floor, and Morena sat with them and put her hands back on the woman's stomach, waiting for the baby to move again, while the one who made shingles pulled back Morena's hair with a carved comb and braided it more tightly than her own mother had ever managed to braid it when she was a child. The teenage girl bit off a single piece of the palm frond with her teeth and tied off the end of her braid while the baby swam beneath Morena's hands. She would say 6 months along. Morena realized that she had not touched a single pregnant woman since it stopped being her business to touch them. How could that be possible? After all the countless bellies she had run her hands over in her training, how had she let them all go?
You knew, didn't you, about the Lakashi, about why Dr. Swenson is here, Anders told you?
Dr. Nkomo asked, the little girl in his lap playing with his glasses. She was gentle as she folded the arms in and out. I'd been told, but I can't say I necessarily believed it. It's something altogether different to see things for myself.
It's true, Dr. Nkomo said, nodding.
I had read Dr. Swenson's papers, but I was still very surprised. I have thought too much about the fertility and reproduction of mosquitoes, and not enough about the fertility and reproduction of women. That's what my wife would say. She says if we wait much longer for a baby, she will have to come and live among the Lakashi in order to get pregnant.
Morena reached back and moved the base of her braid back and forth, trying to loosen it before it gave her a headache. I thought your research was in fertility with Dr. Swenson.
Ah,
Dr. Nkomo said, taking his glasses back from the little girl, and in doing so, breaking her heart all over again.
We work together, we are colleagues, but we do not share the same field of study. Our fields overlap.
Their hosts followed the conversation intently, their faces turning from speaker to speaker as if they were watching a tennis match.
What is your field of study, Dr. Nkomo?
Please, he said, call me Thomas.
I suppose you would say I focus on the drug's off-target toxicity, except in this case it isn't toxic. The drug has exhibited benefits unrelated to fertility.
There were questions to ask, namely, what the benefits were and who was paying for his research. But at that moment, Easter appeared over the top of the ladder, every bit as wet as he had been coming up out of the river and over the side of the boat. Morena understood the look of panic on his face. He was sure she was dead, as she had been sure he was dead. His eyes went quickly around the room, passing over her and stopping only briefly on Thomas and Como. He started to go down the ladder again, but she stood up quickly, and when he realized it was her in that dress, with her hair braided, he bounded up the last few rungs of the ladder, his T-shirt stretched out by the rain, the mud making a solid cake up to his knees. He began slapping his open hands against her arms, her hips, her back. He could not stop himself. She was his responsibility, and he had lost her. The Lakashi nodded and clucked their tongues and pointed at him, but Easter would not look in their direction, and so they gave up. There was no teasing the deaf if they refused to look at you.
The rain is letting up, Thomas said, craning his head to look beyond the edges of the roof. Or maybe it's stopped now and the trees are just dripping. It's very difficult for me to tell the difference between the current rain and the continued falling of the rain we've already had.
I don't mind getting wet again. Morena put her arm around Easter's shoulders. She was thinking about his box, the pens and the feathers, Anders' open letter to the world on his behalf.
Then we should go.
Thomas began a series of deep nods around the room.
How do you say thank you?
To the best of my knowledge, the word doesn't exist in Lakashi. I've asked other people that question and no one comes up with anything.
Morena looked at her hosts, who stared expectantly as if they were hoping she would figure it out.
What about in Portuguese?
Obrigado.
Obrigado,
Morena said to the pregnant woman, but there was no change in expression. She put her hand on the woman's belly again, but the baby was quiet. Easter tugged at the cloth of Morena's dress, then he held out his shirt, pointed at his shirt, and then pointed at her. Morena looked around the room. There were a few hammocks strung between poles, some piles of blankets and clothes on the floor, some baskets with roots and some baskets with twigs. But she did not see her shirt and pants. In truth, if he hadn't mentioned her clothes, she probably would have gone right down the ladder without them. She was so distracted by what she had seen. She shook her head. Easter then went to the pregnant woman and held out his shirt to her between two fingers and pointed to Morena. The woman seemed to have no idea what he was getting at. Morena did a pantomime of unbuttoning her shirt, taking her fingers down the front of her dress where the buttons would have been. But again, the woman shrugged. Thomas then said a word, basa or basi, which was probably the word he believed meant clothes, but it was met with the same blank expression as the Portuguese word for thanks. He held out his own shirt and pointed to Morena. The younger woman took her place on the floor and resumed the twisting and knotting of palm fronds, as if there had never been visitors at all, and then, in what seemed like the most damning gesture of false innocence, the teenage girl sat down to help her. The baby was settled on the floor and given a palm frond to play with, and he put the tip of it in his mouth and sucked contentedly.
"I believe you've been scammed," Thomas said.
"Out of my clothes?" Morena couldn't quite imagine such a thing was possible, even as she stood there in a smock. Easter crossed the room and started digging through a pile on the floor, and one of the men came over and smacked him on the side of the head with the flat of his hand.
"This isn't good," Morena said. "I don't know where my luggage is."
"The bag you came with from Manaus," Thomas said, "wasn't it on the boat with you?"
She turned to him. Suddenly, the dress felt very small.
"Of course it was on the boat with me, but my God, coming into all that fire and screaming, all these men climbing on board from the water, and then the next thing I knew, Dr. Swenson was going up the dock. I wasn't going to stay there and find my luggage."
"Of course," Thomas said.
He did not offer her a single word of encouragement. He did not tell her, as anyone would, that this was a very small village and surely there was no place for her bag to go. The teenage girl was up now, slapping at Easter's hands, and then the littlest girl, the toddler, came over and she hit him as well.
"We should go now, Dr. Singh," Thomas said.
"Please," she said, surprisingly heartbroken over such a small loss. "Call me Morena."